Insight turns 15 this month. We're celebrating this summer by dipping into the pantry to prepare some of our favorite dishes. Today, we're serving up the essentials, food and water. I spoke with Chef Randall Selland and Josh Nelson about The Kitchen. In June, it was named the first and only restaurant in Sacramento to earn a star in the Michelin Guide. We talked about the history of their restaurant empire and philosophy for making the ideal dining experience. Author and journalist Mark Arex joined Cap Radio Reads host Donna Apodoni to talk about water rights and fights. His new book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. We'll revisit the National Geographic documentary Water and Power, A California Heist, and the Rogue Music Project performs an opera in a restaurant. I'm Randall White. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White. Earlier this summer, The Kitchen became the first and only restaurant in Sacramento to earn a star in the Michelin Guide. 2019 was the first year Sacramento restaurants were eligible for the honor. The Kitchen was founded in 1991 by the husband-wife duo, Chef Randall Selland and Chef Nancy Zimmer. They have grown their food empire to 6 restaurants across Sacramento with help from their son, Josh Nelson, and daughter, Tamara Baker. Last week, I spoke with Randall Selland and Josh Nelson about winning that Michelin star and the future of the Selland family restaurants.
I worked in restaurants where I dealt with lethargic staff going back many years, and lethargic staff meaning the fact of if a whole plate of food comes back and the people don't want to take it home and they say they're full, then I think there's something wrong. But as a cook or sous chef, whatever, I can't walk out in the dining room and go, what the hell's the problem? You just go with the flow. And so to me, it's like those people aren't coming back. So The Kitchen was all based on really just direct contact with people and eliminating the wait staff and trying to take care of people and give them food and have fun.
So what in the business they call the back of the house is really the front of the house.
It's all combined.
Uh-huh.
So there was no rhyme or reason for it. We just wanted to do it, and we loved dealing with directly with the people, and it was fun. And the whole family was there. My wife, my son, my daughter. I mean, it was perfect.
And how did you find out about the Michelin star, and what was your reaction?
Now Sacramento has got something that we're noticed for. And we tried for years to get people to notice what we were doing in Sacramento and what a great city this is. My family, we love this place. But everybody go, oh, wow, it's really cool what you do. That's great. So what part of San Francisco or L.A. or what? You know, we're in Sacramento. And they go, well, where's that? So the state capital. And so nobody ever had an interest in our city. So
thanks.
Nobody had an interest in our city, and that's what, to me, it means. And it's great for Sacramento. It's great for the chefs and managers that work with us at The Kitchen. They're doing a phenomenal job.
Sacramento has always been Sacramento. We've always had great restaurants, but we've never had the possibility of getting a Michelin star. And so I think people have just worked from their heart and put things out that they wanted to put out. And it's actually kind of neat that now Michelin snuck into the market. And all that work that everyone did, which was very, you know, no pun intended, organic and true, really resonated and obviously got them to put Sacramento in the market.
So, Randall, take us back to 1991. You and your wife, Nancy, were both chefs at the time, and that's when you first opened The Kitchen. Why did you decide to leap into restaurant ownership?
As Josh talks about things happening organically. And that's kind of what happened to us is we actually looked up 20-some years after opening up and went, oh, my gosh, look, we got all these restaurants and there's like 350 people that work with us. And it's very humbling for us. Back then, it was just a matter of we wanted to do, as I alluded to before, we wanted to take care of people and have direct contact with them and make it fun, make dining fun. And it's funny on how this whole counter service thing has taken off and people watching people cook in the kitchens. And for us, it just seemed like a natural thing to do is we love people, love talking to them, love taking care of them. So why not have that direct contact instead of being behind 4 walls and not knowing whether they like things or not? Because you know you can't make everybody happy. So the idea, and this is one of the reasons why I think The Kitchen has been successful, is we don't care if you want a piece of meatloaf and a cheese pizza. I'll have Selland's and 8th Street bring it over to us, and I'll make a fancy shape or something. And, you know, the whole idea of what we do is people give us our hard-earned money to take care of them and show them a good time. And any chef or manager, any restaurant owner that says, well, they're just not for this place or they don't know food or whatever that might be, we have the opposite attitude. And there's a lot of chefs in this town that have that love and passion that we do. And that's why Sacramento is such a great food city. That's where it came from.
You chose a place outside the grid. Now, in 1991, Midtown and downtown were really different places than they are today. But how did you end up choosing Arden Arcade to put the kitchen?
Well, wasn't really a choice. So my wife was doing catering at the time. Nancy was doing catering at the time. And we were actually living downtown. And we were doing it all out of our house on E Street. I think statute of limitations is over now. Doing dishes in the bathtub and whatever it might be. I mean, just trying to make it work. And I was working 6 days a week in restaurants. And I was working for a person, Bernice Hagen, who had Bernice's Cookery over in the Five Point Shopping Center. And I'd followed a chef that had taught me how to cook, Kevin Nichols, from the old cookery with Jean-Luc Chassereau. Gosh, a long, long time ago. And Bernice kept saying, oh, people, you know, there's homeless people sleeping there and people break into the kitchen. And I said, well, hey, you know, Nancy would love to have a kitchen to do catering out of. So why don't we'll move and we'll rent a little house in front and take over the kitchen in the back. And that's how it all started. And Marcus Graziano from Capital Cellars wanted Nancy to do, he wanted to bring people in, sell them wine and have us do some little food. And so we did that. Nobody bought any wine, but they loved what we were doing. And so we said, well, let's try this. And that's where it all came about.
Never the intent to do a restaurant from the beginning. You know, on the very first night, we've all worked in the restaurant since day one. And I remember we literally at the end of the night, we're like, that was really fun. We should do this again. Started doing it once a month on Randall's day off and then twice a month. And then, 28 years later, here we are. But I can tell you that even going and working in the restaurant a night at this point, it's still fun. And we've always made that a priority for that restaurant. It's one of the things that I think creates the magic in there is that you go in and we strip away all the pretension and allow people to really relax and enjoy themselves and have a good time. And how we do that is by having a good time ourselves.
Nancy and I are out of everything. In fact, I just to tell you a quick story, it's funny because we were kind of out of day-to-day operations for like 6 months. And I looked at her and I said, why don't I not want to go in? Why do I just, I don't have an interest. I don't need to do this anymore. And she goes, because we're either all in or we're all out. We're either like 24/7, which is why I always tell people when they want to open up a business, I said, you know, keep your day job in case your new thing doesn't work out. And they go, well, why would I do that? I'm working 24/7. I go, that's the idea of having your own business. And Nancy and I are kind of out of it. It's Josh and Tamara and their friends actually doing it. And we're giving them any help they can get. But it's all our kids. It's the second generation now moving on.
What was the first restaurant outside of the kitchen?
Sellens
on 8th Street. Yeah.
East
Tamara and Nancy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
December 2001.
Yeah. Nancy and Tamara had this idea to do the cafe. And Nancy and I had just moved to East Sacramento because our Tamara had our first grandchild and we were living out in Carmichael and she was downtown and we said, you drive out to Carmichael? And she goes, it's too far. You drive downtown? And we said, we're not going to do that. And she says, you guys love it down in East Sac. You should move down. So we rented a house and bought a house 6 months later and never looked back. But it's funny, we're driving down 8th Street and we drove by where Sellens and Nancy goes, that's it. And I go, what do you mean with that? So what do you mean? And she says, that's where I want to open up the cafe. And I said, all right. So we did it. And it's been a great success for us. And it's helped us a lot. And what's funny is
Josh, they signed a lease.
Yes.
I need a business plan.
That's exactly what happened. But what's funny is people see me with Nancy. And I'm, of course, the face of the company. And the only thing the whole family says to this day, the only mistake they made with any of the restaurants is they put me out front and put my name on stuff. Because people always think it's all me, and it's like, no, it's the family. I'm just the face.
So just for the record, my mother, Nancy Zimmer, and my sister, Tamara Baker, are the founders of the restaurant group.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh. So we should bring them in right now.
Well, they needed me.
I'll see you guys later.
It would be a more interesting conversation, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm just teasing. Yeah. How many restaurants are you up to now?
We have six restaurants. We have 3 Sellens. Oboe Italian Table and Bar, Ella Dining Room and Bar, and the kitchen.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Chef Randall Selland and CFO Josh Nelson about their family restaurant, The Kitchen. It was recognized as a 1-star Michelin restaurant earlier this year. And back to that, describe the process through which restaurants are considered and then awarded stars. It's very secretive, and you don't know when the people are there doing the judging, right?
I don't know the process because it is very secretive. But yeah, they come in the restaurant, and from what I understand, they come in the restaurant a handful of times. And so we can look back now at the Michelin guide and see the dishes that they mention, right? And we change our menu constantly, right? So we're able to identify when we think they were there, which was like a year and a half ago. Is when it started. So from the dishes in the guide and matching them up to our menus, we can see that they came over a period of at least a year before they made any kind of announcement.
And they could be there today working on the next one, right? You don't get a star and keep it for life. You continually have to upkeep the star, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the star, they do re-review the restaurants every single year. I think that any restaurant now that's like aspiring to be in next year's guide, they're probably not going to be. They're going to probably be, you know, 2 years out if they are able to catch the attention. But it's a process, and it definitely takes time. We obviously have great food and great service, or we think so. and the kitchen also, what's unique about it is that it's not a normal restaurant. We've put the kitchen in the dining room, essentially. We allow you to be in the back of house the whole time. And so you get to see a lot of the underbelly. And historically, the Michelin restaurants, you have everything tucked away. It's a very quiet, controlled environment. And the kitchen's just literally the exact opposite.
the exact opposite
of that.
And so exhibition as you can get almost,
yeah,
right?
We have all the bells and whistles, but the traditional environment of a restaurant, we've really stripped away and flipped on its head.
Randall, you touched on this a little bit already, but I want you to go a little more into it. How has Sacramento's restaurant scene changed since you opened the kitchen? How have you seen it change?
You know, it's funny. Good cooks, good chefs, they left Sacramento to go somewhere else. I was always here. You know, Nace, I had two small children, and so we're not going anywhere. And so we put them to work. But that being said, as time has gone on, people all of a sudden, they leave town, and we've gotten chefs and people that work with us that have gone to New York and L.A. and San Francisco, and then all of a sudden, you know, they leave single and they come back married with a kid or two, and they're coming back because it's like, I need babysitters, I need a place I can actually afford to live in, and so they come back here. So we're just getting so many people coming back to Sacramento to be part of what we've got going here. And again, the kitchen was started on kind of a, not even a whim, just a, let's just do this, and we'll do our style of food and our flavors, and we'll go to the farmer's market all the time and deal with little small farmers and just, you know, survive. And that's kind of what we were doing. The whole idea in the beginning was to keep a roof over our heads, keep our little car running, which barely ran, and keep Josh in little Izod shirts and, nice, you know, and make the kids lunch every day for their school. And that was our premise for the whole thing. And that's why, again, it's like we're, Nate and I feel like the luckiest people in the world.
Well, Chef Randall Sellen, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And son Josh Nelson, who's running the ship right now at Sellen Family Restaurants, thank you for being here today as well.
Randall, thank you for having us.
That's Chef Randall Sellen and CEO Josh Nelson talking with me last week about the kitchen winning a Michelin star. They're planning to open Bock on R Street later this year in collaboration with Rob Archie from Urban Roots Brewing and Smokehouse. We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. Mark Arax is an award-winning journalist and author. He's reported extensively on how the water history and future of California has been shaped by the battle between powerful agricultural interests and large cities. Mark Arax sat down with Cap Radio Reads host Donna Appadoni to talk about his latest book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Here's an excerpt of that conversation. Mark starts by talking about how he first became interested in California water rights.
My grandparents, after we sold the last ranch along the San Joaquin River, they moved to a suburb in Fresno called Fig Garden. And three houses down was this huge irrigation canal. And my grandmother made me promise that I would never go near it.
Why?
She said, do not go near it. It's got a magical power to it. It will lure you up and into the waters, and you will drown. And she said, and no one will come to save your body. And don't get the wrong idea about my grandmother, but I said, why not, Grandma? She said, because The flow of one irrigation canal is much more important to the valley than the body of one silly boy. And in a way, that was true. I mean, there were times when particularly Mexican kids would, that would be their, they would swim there, they would drown, and their bodies wouldn't be recovered for months. Because to recover would mean to shut down that flow. So I had a sense that something was strange, but I never bothered to ask, you know, where that water was coming from, where it was going, and to whom and by what right. That's when I had a sense.
Fascinating. So we start with snowmelt, and we have streams and rivers that come into the valley, and we have an aquifer. Which part of that is most related to the politics of water?
Well, let's start with the proposition that the men who took this land from the natives, 300,000 natives, and they were wiped out by three kinds of invasions. First, the Spanish invasion, and then Mexico for a time, and then Sutter coming in. And I do a whole chapter on Sutter. When the Americans take over, they decide that they're going to declare the entire edge of this continent, 1,000 miles long, as one state. And that right there was a bit of hubris, but it also put a challenge in front of them. How do you make the parts of that state equal when there are actually eight different states of nature within? And that's where the proposition came that we need to move the rain. And it started with the gold rush. The mining of gold was really the mining of water first.
Subsidence is a big part of what you write about. The sinking of the land, which we don't think about, and it might be more evident in parts of the state than it is in others, but there are parts of the state where the land has sunk a lot.
No, the aqueduct itself, they pumped so much water out in this last drought that the aqueduct, there are four or five pools of it, that have sunk so much that the gravity flow is no longer working. And we're all spending hundreds of millions of dollars in electricity to try to get that water, pump it through its dead spots. And right now along the Frying Kern Canal, which is, the aqueduct is on the west side, the Frying Kern Canal is on the east side, part of that has sunk so much, it's not serving, going all the way to Bakersfield the way the water used to. And there's some bills right now in the legislature to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to fix that problem. It's interesting that there's going to be no contribution from the irrigation districts or the farmers who did the pumping.
There are canals all over the country. There are dams all over the country.
When you're saying and country, you mean the country.
I mean like the U.S.
Oh,
kind
you
of
mean
country.
The U.S. Okay.
I don't mean rural areas, okay. That okay. Kind of country. I mean, and all over every country, dams and canals are a part of how we get water from one place to another. What makes the Central Valley different and what makes it not the best situation?
It's not to the extent that it is in the valley. We altered the landscape. There's geological studies that show this. We alter the landscape in the San Joaquin Valley more than any place on Earth. And we did it through scrapers. We did it through land levelers. So it's a dramatic alteration of the land. And then we took these rivers and we made them run backward.
When people in other states look at California and they look at some of our environmental laws and practices, when it comes to pollution of the air, for example, and how we handle that, people from other states look at us and say, wow, you know, they really take it to the extreme there. But, you know, if you think about it, it's pretty good. They're doing some really good things, and maybe we're not going to follow or copy California, but, you know, we tip our hats. We see that California's in a good direction for them. When it comes to water, I don't know what people are saying in other states, but it doesn't seem like we're being very progressive.
No, we're one of the last states to regulate groundwater, the pumping of it. It took us 165 years. There's a character in this book about midway through. His name is Harding, Sidney Harding. He's a professor at UC Berkeley. And to make a little extra money, he goes to work for the state in summer during the summers, and he works for farmers and consults. And he starts putt-putting in his little Model T Ford down the valley in the 1920s, and he discovers the seeds of a disaster. The farmers have just taken this new turbine pump, and they're going deeper and deeper into the earth to bring out water because they've already used up the flow of the rivers, and now they need the flow of the aquifer to grow farmland even more. And he's warning, he's like a Cassandra, he's warning that this is going to be a real problem. You can't chase that water all the way to hell. But they ignore him. And it's not until 100 years later that we see the wisdom. So yeah, when people say California is very progressive and we're on the cutting edge of environmental stuff, that did not apply itself to groundwater.
I didn't understand at first some of the changes that have taken place in what people have farmed, what people have grown. And I talked to a retired farmer, and I said, well, what did you grow on your land? He said, what year?
Yeah.
What? It has changed a lot. The crop, the product has changed dramatically over the years. Because of water or because of demand?
No, because of price. I mean, no one can change faster than a farmer. I mean, you know, he's pulling out, you know, I can take you to certain fields in the valley that began as wheat and then became a vineyard for raisins, and then it was tree fruit, and then it's nuts. And there's no almost sentimental kind of thing about it. It's just, yeah, my dad and grandpa, they grew vines for 100 years, but look at the price of almonds, and you're seeing that conversion happen all the time. So you're right, as soon as they notice that change, the first farmer that follows, the rest of them follow through. And then what happens is that crop becomes a glut. Mm. The price goes down, and then the reinvention happens all over again.
You also observed something else in terms of politics that you wrote about that surprised you a little bit, that a farmer actually talked about those two bad words, climate change.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something that they talked about before. Now they're coming around, they're using the term a little bit more freely.
Can I tell a little story?
Please.
I won't make it too long. So the apricots in my backyard in the middle of the drought started blooming in January, early January, and it was really weird. And it was a nice heavy bloom, and they set heavy, and I thought, I was already counting the mason jars. You know, I was going to make my Armenian sun jam. And then one morning in March, I went out and I looked, and the trees were weightless. And all the nubs of those apricots were at the floor, thousands of them. And so I called up one of my farmer friends. And we have a fun game. He farms about 8,000 acres of things. And I always compare my experiments in my backyard with his 8,000 acres. And he just shakes his head and says, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I said, Brad, you have to come see my apricot trees. It was like a mass shedding, and I can't figure out what. And he said, let me show you my nuts. So he picked me up, and we drove to his pistachios. See, pistachios need to be fertilized. So for every 24 females, there's one male. And these guys have a funny sense of humor, these farmers. They paint the trunk of the pistachio rooster red. So he's spanking all the pods on the males, and no pollen is coming off, and he can't figure it out. He says, I've never seen my orchard out of sync like this. And I said, well, what is it? And he kind of scuffed his boots, and he said, it's climate change. Pretty bold for a farmer to say that. And so what was happening in my little backyard orchard there, in his big orchard, was the same thing. We did not have enough chilling hours in the winter to put those trees in hibernation. You have to be asleep. You have to kind of touch death as a tree to then produce life in the spring. And that's what was happening. And that kind of is, actually, that happens in chapter one. So it's kind of a mystery story that propels you through the narrative. And I find a couple of these devices because most of the water books I read kind of put me to sleep. And so I didn't want anybody falling asleep in this book. Even though it weighs 2.2 pounds, I hope that it keeps you going. So these mysteries were a way to carry the narrative forward.
Mark Arax, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
The Drent Land.
That's Mark Arax speaking with Donna Appadoni about his book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Make sure to subscribe to the Cap Radio Reads podcast now, and you will get the full version of that conversation in your feed later this summer. We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. National Geographic's 2017 documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist, is about water, water rights, and what's grown where and how drought figures in. The film premiered at the Sundance Festival that year. In May 2017, Insight host Beth Ruyak spoke with filmmaker Marina Zenovich and the documentary's protagonist, attorney Adam Keats. They started the conversation with Keats describing what's at stake.
It's not about quantity. It's about distribution. It's about control. And the greater the amount of water that we have, the greater amount of water that these players, the captains of the industry, the major agribusiness industry that's controlling the water, the more they're going to take. So the issue is how we decide to distribute the resources that we have. The second part of it is that what we know in California is that we will have drought again. And then the question is what will happen when the drought returns.
And just from the beginning to say, you're in this battle over private holdings of public lands.
I'd say it's private control over what should be a public resource. There is land above the resource, but the resource is this giant aquifer of water and all the water that's stored in the aquifer.
The distinction between land and water is important, also legal and illegal, because there is a lot of movement that happens between these players and among them that is legal because of the original agreements and amendments.
That's right. A lot of the arrangements that happen right now are technically legal under the way the rules and the way the contracts are written. It's our position that the contracts themselves are illegal, and we're trying to reverse the contracts. It's difficult for us to go after the transactions that are being made right now. What we can do is go after the framework in which they enable these transactions to happen. That's what we're doing.
We're somewhat talking around what the core of this is, but Marina, you told this story in dramatically different visuals. We see families with cases of bottled water in their living rooms and the shower heads that just have a trickle, and they're surrounded by lush green fields of almond trees, or in the Paso Robles area, grapevines with gorgeous trickles and running water through the fields and between the rows. What did you want people to know about the story of water in California?
Well, we just wanted to kind of show a world that people aren't really privy to. I mean, I'm in Los Angeles, a million miles away from Central California, where a lot of this is happening. We wanted to show partially the drought. We wanted to show the history of how the State Water Project was put together and focus on the Monterey Amendments and kind of how this public resource was essentially privatized.
With that, let's hear a little clip of the documentary, and just to put in perspective what, as Adam referenced, water has become in this state.
Water has become gold to be traded and sold, and we're extracting it in the same way. But it's not enough. The more water we need, the more water we will always need.
That phrase made me stop and think. The more we need, the more we'll always need. Adam, let's get to the specific of the Kern County Basin and Stuart and Linda Resnick. Will you explain who they are and the role they play in the California water system?
Sure. The Resnicks are a very well-known, politically influential, charitable couple from Beverly Hills. They're very smart capitalists. They have businesses in a whole bunch of different fields. They run Teleflora. They run Fiji Water. They run the Franklin Mint. Palm, wonderful. I mean, this is a very diversified, very large company owned by two people who are very good business people. They got into almonds and pistachios early by buying up degraded, poor soiled, poor watered land in the southern San Joaquin Valley. And they planted trees that they required a tremendous amount of water. And they went through their, I would say, political connections and their political and economic power to acquire that water. and take that water from someplace else. And they've been watering their trees now for 20, 30 years and developing a massive almond and pistachio and other nut tree, you know, and citrus also, but tree farm permanent crop economy in a part of the state, a part of the world that can't sustainably support it.
So let's listen to another piece of the documentary, and it's self-explanatory.
The myth is that as the agribusinesses benefit, the communities benefit.
How's the water at the school? Do you guys drink the water at the school?
No.
It tastes like blood?
But in the case of the Resniks, even with their, you know, slideshow ready charity, no, you see that the Resniks, you know, jump up the Forbes list of billionaires and the workers can't even drink their tap water.
Marina, there is a sign that we see pretty early on in the documentary, and it says, is growing food wasting water? So that's the core question there. And really for state officials and the world is, this is a deeply productive, successful agricultural area that's feeding the state and the world. And yet there is this picture of parched families and parched lives in that part. Did you see that there was a place where there could be a better balance than what you visualized and depict in the documentary?
Well, hopefully this movie is going to get people talking about it to try to find a place, because I don't know about you, Adam, but I don't. Other than kind of less production of investment farming, I think there's a difference between big ag and small ag.
Adam, will you describe on what basis you are challenging, and by your own words in the film, water law in California is a nightmare?
To get in the details would require about a day and maybe actually a career to understand what's happening with the law here. It's arcane and it's Byzantine. The very simple answer is that the contracts that were signed back in the 60s for the operation of the State Water Project required certain balances. And the Monterey Amendments that were negotiated in secret in 1995, 96, and then, you know, went into place in 97, upset that balance. And upsetting that balance was not just a strategic, you know, or economic decision. It actually was a political decision. And that political decision violated the Constitution and violated state laws. And we've been saying since 2010, when I got involved, and then other people since before that, we need to have a court address those constitutional and statutory violations of that deal.
At some point along the way, there was a tip from a Department of Water Resources employee pointing to the Kern Water Bank and giving someone direction. Did that come to you, Adam?
No, it went to the Planning and Conservation League. An employee, a former employee of DWR, was given some contracts to go through and realized what was happening, and she called PCL and got the ball rolling, and that's how the first lawsuit came about.
So time passes, and these agreements that were made and the amendments decades ago, do they just get quiet over time and it becomes business as usual?
Yes. I mean, and when I first filed this case in 2010, I think that there was a surprise that we even filed it to begin with. There was a surprise that there was someone new came along that actually had energy to keep battling. And one of the lawyers, one of my opposing counsel laughed and said, you know, your kids are going to be in college before this thing gets anywhere near concluding. The people that filed this back in the 90s, I mean, this is a struggle that's been going on since the late 90s. Lawyers have retired, you know, children have grown. I mean, this is, and there's no end in sight. I laughed at it in 2010. I said, you know, I move a little faster than some of these guys. I'm not in this for the career. I'm in this to get stuff done. And here I am, you know, 7 years later, and God knows when this is going to finish.
So back to this issue of what's legal and what's illegal, and maybe the better question is what's morally right and what isn't. Marina, what did you come away believing out of this?
Well, there's a great moment in the film when Tony Rossman, who's one of the lawyers from the original Monterey Amendment lawsuit, says, you know, someone advised me early in my career never to underestimate the power of greed. And that is what this is all about for me. I think with regards to this film, with regards to what's happening in this country right now, it's all about greed. How much is enough?
Yeah, great point.
So do I understand correctly that the only way the Monterey agreements would be able to be reversed is for judges to somehow be involved and see that there was a judicial role in all of this, Adam?
Yes. I think that this is our last hope of reversing it at this point, would be to have the judges recognize their duty and their role in stepping in and taking care of this. Absolutely. The law is there and the facts are there. I mean, our case is very good. The problem is that there's been 20 years of operation and 20 years of cementing and hardening of this whole thing. And how do you get past that? That's the challenge.
What do you expect is going to happen in the Kern County area?
It's a dynamic case, and the case involves water in the ground. But long term, the new normal is the last 5 years, punctuated by brief, crazy storms that are going to throw everything into chaos. But we can't relax. We can't think that the problem is solved.
To add just a bit of history, going back in time, we've always had this battle between North and South. More people live in the South, more water and snow and rain are in the North. So long ago, when there were just battles, when there couldn't be any agreements, and you depict that in the documentary, this solution with the Resniks somehow ended up being the compromise place. And that's where it emerged. It allowed people in that fight over water to reach an agreement, correct?
Yeah, that's true to the extent that you allow a battle between two players that are in a mutual agreement already. I mean, the public was cut out of that debate. The environment was cut out of the debate. The fishermen were cut out of the debate. The salmon industry. That debate was just between Los Angeles and Kern County. And they're both, you know, on one side of the debate when it comes down to it. That's the whole problem.
So is this situation playing out anywhere else in the United States?
Water privatization in general is a problem throughout the country.
Sure.
We saw at the end of the Big Short, this great scene where it's apocryphal now. You know, what's the next big thing? It's going to be water.
He says water.
Right.
Yeah, buy water.
There is definitely an agenda to commodify water and to make it into something that can be bought and sold in the marketplace. And that is my group's struggle, is to stop that from happening. The Kern Water Bank is one of the largest and most visible efforts in that
fight.
Battle, in that fight. Yeah, thank you. Exactly. However you want to call it.
That was Beth Rueck in conversation with filmmaker Marina Zenovich and attorney Adam Keats. They were talking about National Geographic's 2017 documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist. You can hear more of our favorite segments at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. The Rogue Music Project is a five-piece collective focusing on opera and classical music. The group includes Cap Radio classical hosts Kevin Doherty and Jennifer Reason, plus Sarah Fitch, Omari Tao, and Carrie Hennessy. This weekend, they're performing the 1952 opera by Hugo Weisgall called The Stronger in a unique setting, Magpie Cafe in Sacramento. I sat down last week with performer Carrie Hennessy, director Omari Tao, and Magpie Cafe owner Ed Rohr to talk about the production.
Rogue Music Project has been working on developing this season of cabarets and small pieces. And one of the things that we really wanted to do was to sort of find alternative space to create operatic experiences. And Magpie's my brunch spot, so I hang out there all the time. And I know Seamus Coots of M5 Arts, Art Hotel, and all those different things. He and I were talking about this project, and he said, well, why don't you think about Magpie? And I thought, that's an option. And so he talked with Ed. Ed and I got together along with Seamus, and we sat around and talked about what that could look like. And they were gracious enough to say, yeah, let's try this strange new thing in our space.
Ed, how do you go about doing that in a restaurant? You have to have seatings so that people aren't ordering throughout the entire performance and that sort of thing?
Well, I think because the piece is about 20 minutes long, that it's not going to be a real big challenge for us. But this is all supposed to take place in a restaurant, and so it's not going to be too difficult to make it seem like an actual restaurant. So we're just going to kind of go with it. I think we'll probably have 20 minutes where we're dark with service. But other than that, we just anticipate people eating and experiencing the piece and being part of the experience as well.
Carrie, you're very used to performing in acoustically designed spaces, right? How does Magpie fit into that?
Well, it's going to be interesting. Most of the time I'm singing in 2,000-seat halls over very large orchestras. So there are going to be times where perhaps vocally it might be uncomfortable for people's ears, which is okay. I'm also a sensitive singer. I could do this. But there are times where it's going to be so immediate that the actual vibration of my voice will vibrate people's being, like their bones will shake a bit. And I think in the appropriate moments, it's going to be such a visceral experience that, like it or don't like the piece, you won't forget it.
That's one way to look at it. Right?
Well, it is. It's such an emotionally driven experience to watch what this woman is going through that I think it's really important to play with the space. So after we decided to do it at Magpie, I'd been there many times, but I'd never paid attention to that kind of thing. So making sure that when I would go back and have drinks with people or go eat dinner or go have lunch, that I was sort of sensing what that might feel like and the sensitivity that's necessary for a piece like this anyway, making sure that people can understand the words, making sure that the emotional drama is carried in the softs, the louds, the color, the tempo, and making sure that everyone's receiving that in the right amount. But sometimes it's going to get to be a little much.
It's going to be
purposefully. And so I can just open it up at times.
Are there some seats where people might not be able to hear as well?
No.
No.
It's going to be fine. I've never been accused of not being heard.
No. Have you been at a restaurant where she was there just laughing?
Just laughing.
Yeah, no, and she's placed also sort of in the middle. This sort of takes place in the round, as it were, so it's in the middle of the restaurant. So you can't really miss it or hear it. The way we staged her, she's moving around the table, she turns, and she faces different directions, so you're not going to miss it.
So help set this up for us. Is everyone that's eating at Magpie that night automatically part of this, or do you have to sign up in advance?
We actually have ticket sales for this special event. So Ed and Janelle have extended the hours for their Friday, Saturday evenings for us, and they opened up especially on Monday when they're usually closed. But yeah, we're expecting that they eat and drink and have a good time. There will be a piano rolled in for this event, so there's piano music happening.
Before and after.
Before
cool.
and
opera.
After.
Yeah.
There's a sort of a mixer after. They can continue to have a little cocktail and listen to some fantastic music by great musicians. So.
Oh, yeah, two wonderful pianists.
Yes.
And to add to that for just a moment, I think on Friday and Saturday night, after around 8 o'clock, if we have any walk-in traffic, we'll be inviting people to dine outside or maybe at the bar, so that we can start to open up space for the folks that are arriving to actually enjoy the experience. So we're going to just try to keep real fluid and keep an open mind about how we work things, and we'll start to open up tables for the guests that are here for the Rogue Music Project, and any of our normal Magpies, we'll be able to help them out outside or in a different place.
Omari, Rogue Music Project consists of how many people?
Five people.
And for transparency, we should let people know that Cap Radio's classical music hosts Jennifer Reason and Kevin Doherty are part of that.
That is correct.
Is everyone involved in this production?
Yes and no. Kevin will be there to introduce the group. He's sort of our
MC.
That's generally his job at these events.
Yeah.
He's great at it. And so he'll be there to introduce the event. But playing the piano, our orchestra, is Miss Jennifer Reason. So she has a big part in it. She is the heart and soul of the character. The phrase is, the orchestra doesn't lie. So what Jennifer is playing will be what is going on in Estelle's mind, what Carrie is singing.
And let's talk a little bit about the storyline. Carrie, how much can you tell us without giving away too much?
Well, I think, again, like I said earlier, it's really the conversation you don't want to hear next to you in a restaurant. It's it's uncomfortable.
I was a bartender for years, trust me.
You've heard it all.
I've heard it all. Yeah.
Right. So Estelle walks into this bar on Christmas Eve after she's done shopping to have a little drink to kind of get ready to go home for the evening, and turns around and sees her friend Lisa, and I use the word friend because there's a lot revealed about their long relationship together and what that means. That's the entire interaction of the opera, is really sort of sensing who they are, what they mean to one another, and Lisa doesn't speak the entire opera. So it's all from sort of Estelle's point of view until you really watch Lisa's reactions to what's happening.
Singer Carrie Hennessy there with the Rogue Music Project. We're also joined by Omari Tao and chef Ed Rohrer from Magpie, where The Stronger will be performed coming up on July 19th, 20th, and 22nd. This is an opera in a restaurant. And
yes, it is.
Here we go.
Oh, yeah.
And we have some of that, don't we? We can
Correct.
Hear a bit.
We have a moment here where Estelle has just finished discussing what her husband is like at home when he gets angry. And then she sort of says, I'm being mean when I'm sort of talking about him in public, but he's really quite wonderful. She introduces one of the great themes of the opera musically, this big extended arpeggio that she sings really highly. It's gorgeous.
Carrie Hennessy there with the Rogue Music Project. Omari, you were mentioning if it's a success, you might look other places and expand on this idea.
Well, the idea of us performing in other places, that's going to happen. But this is a limited engagement, and I have been told by the artists performing that this is not happening again.
I mean, not right away.
Not right away.
I might faceplant. I'm going to faceplant on Monday. It's a lot.
When you experience it, you're going to be in for a treat, obviously, but there's a lot of hard work that goes into this. The music is challenging, the story, the drama is challenging, and we're hoping that out of that comes some really great conversations so that we can have more events like this. Yeah, we want to do more stuff like this. That's what Rogue is all about.
And so challenging for the performers and for setting it up. But so there will be interaction. It'll appear as though there's interaction with the wait staff and the singers.
Yes.
Or the singer, I guess, in this case.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. That must be challenging for your co-actor. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Well, I think as we've been running things, the interest, she and I are very close. The energy between us is very clear. So as soon as we're both in that space together of the show, we click and we're reacting to one another very deliberately. So I don't think it's as hard as she thought it might be or as hard as I thought it might be. I've done one woman operas before where my only interaction is a ringing phone. That's great. This is actually a little bit more interesting to have another person on stage with you and utilizing their body language. It's kind of what I do all day long anyway when I'm working with students or, you know, you're in interactions and meetings, you're reading body language, but usually people are yappity-yapping with it. So this is kind of interesting to see the looks and the turns and the body language and reacting as Estelle to that.
Does this push the limits of how long you can go as a solo performer where you're doing all of the singing?
No, not necessarily. I'm from Midwest stock. I'm pretty hardcore. I'm okay. And with the right vocal technique, as long as you, I mean, singers really tend to know their bodies extremely well. So I know the second that I need to stop singing, I know where my point of diminishing returns is. But Omari and I walked the show yesterday. We went, did two full run-throughs back to back. I woke up this morning, I warmed up, and I went through some notes, and I sang a little bit before I got here. So it's fine. I just need to know when to rest, and my body's real clear.
On
face
when that
plant
is.
On
yeah.
Monday.
Absolutely.
Omari, I asked you about future projects along this line. Ed, how about you? Would Magpie, if this all goes really well, would you consider maybe keeping a piano in there? Because the piano's being rolled in, right? That's not typically there.
I mean, we're all out here just trying to have fun in the world. And I certainly wouldn't be averse to doing anything that was fun. I mean, I guess we'll see, right? Yeah.
They're buying them tickets, so.
There you go.
Right? It does sound fun. Carrie Hennessy, thank you for being on Insight. Good
thank
luck
you.
With the show.
Thank you.
And Omari, also with Rogue Music Project, thank you for being on the show.
Thank
Omari
you
Tao.
So much.
And Ed Rohrer, the chef at Magpie, good luck with having an opera performed in your restaurant coming up.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
And break a leg, right?
Sure. That's it. Yeah.
That's don't right. break
Perfect.
Too many dishes.
No.
Oh. At least one.
He doesn't know.
That's okay.
Don't say that.
We've lost a few martini glasses. Right.
That's Magpie Cafe owner Ed Rohrer with Carrie Hennessy and Omari Tao with the Rogue Music Project. The Rogue Music Project will perform The Stronger at Magpie in Sacramento on July 19th, 20th, and 22nd. There's ticket and show information on our website, capradio.org. And that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We get help from Antonio Muniz and Helen Barrington. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer, Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.